We'll start simply, perhaps, with Jane, if you want to tell us who you are.
Okay, my name's Jane Corbett. I live in Everton, which is in North Liverpool, which is a brilliant little community, but is pretty badly looked down on sometimes because it's got a very, very high jobless rate of just over 42% of those of working age. Lived there for about 30 years now. Got involved in community action about 30 years ago, and I've been a Labour councillor since 2002 for the Everton ward. So lots of sort of stories and stuff that we've been involved in with Everton. In terms of this particular theme, the stuff that I've been really challenged about recently is Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett's work on inequality, which talks about people being judged on what they earn and what they own more than the content of their character, as Martin Luther King would say, and how that actually reflects in our little community, where people actually haven't got much money to buy, therefore they're not high-level consumers, and are they cut out of that whole world, and does that matter? And how actually, what is worth about? And then the whole thing as a Christian about who are we and how are we seen by society versus what does God think of us, and does God treat us on the level? Yes, God does. And what worth is. So that sort of agenda.
Thanks, Jane. My name is Neil Lawson. By day, I chair a think tank come pressure group on the centre of left of British politics called Compass, which tries to talk about the issues of equality, sustainability and democracy, and tries to wrap those three big themes together into something reasonably, and we hope, coherent, and to argue that you can't have a more equal world or a more sustainable world or a more democratic world on their own. You have to put the three bits together. We're trying to explore the ideas basis for bringing those three themes together and the organisational basis. We work a lot with the Labour Party, but not exclusively the Labour Party, and try and build coalitions of people who are interested in building a better life and a better world. By night, I'm the author of a recent book called All Consuming, which is about the way in which our lives have become, or many of our lives, or much of our lives has become about shopping and consumption, why that happened, how it happened, who benefits, what the consequences are, and what we might do instead. Because I think that consumerism and the deal of consumerism, the way in which it seduces us and the way in which it compensates us for a properly free and full life, is at the centre of much of the, or many of the problems, the individual, social, environmental and political problems that we have, and we need to understand it and our role in consumer society if we want to move beyond it to something better.
Wow. You're good on this panel.
I'm going to fall off in a minute. That's what I'm worried about.
Alistair, you're next.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm Alistair McIntosh. By day, I live in the Greater Govan area of Glasgow, where I'm a campaigning academic, a writer. I speak at events like this. Recently, I published a book called Hell and High Water, Climate Change, Hope and the Human Condition, which, as a result of some confusion, the bookshop here didn't get in time. But that's my book in which I discuss consumerism and the consumerism as the underpinning of not just climate change, but also the credit crunch. I'm probably better known in Scotland for my work on land reform in a rural context, though quite a bit of my attention these days was urban deprivation in the area where I'm living.
Eugenie.
Thank you. Thank you. My name's Eugenie Harvey, and by day I am the co-founder and a director of a social movement which is called We Are What We Do, which was launched 5 years ago with a book which some of you may know called Change the World for a Fiver, 50 Actions to Change the World and Make You Feel Good. We Are What We Do aims to harness the popular mood to take issues of sustainability out of the pages of G2, which is, of course, important that they're there, but put them into the pages of Heat magazine and into the area of popular culture, because we believe that if we are to capture the interest of the mainstream, then that's where we need to put these ideas. My background is in communications. I did a mass communications degree in Australia. I've lived in the UK for 10 years. I am the proud husband of Andy Thornton and mother of Cara Thornton by night and by day, my love.
So, Andy, are you the proud wife of... I thought so, here we are. Okay, so in a moment, we're going to get these guys talking a little bit more, and then we'll come to you for questions, because you can see we've got a right good panel for this topic. So you, in a moment, we'll all descend into a heated debate. But before we get there, let's let them talk a bit more. Jane, as you were talking, I thought, isn't it the case that consumerism actually has increased all sorts of quality of life for all sorts of people? And whilst it might be hip on this panel to say it's a terrible bad thing, actually, it's actually done an awful lot of good for a lot of people, and people's length of their lives has improved as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, if you look at Liverpool, for example, over 30 years, Liverpool's changed dramatically. There's been a massive amount of government funding and European money poured in, billions and billions gone in, and there has been a big, big change. So the poverty level has gone up in terms of less poverty. However, what's happened is that there's been a gap developed. If you look at the deprivation indices across Liverpool, you'll see a big gap developing between the north end and the south end of the city, apart from Speke, which is very south in the city. And if you look at the Wilkinson Pickett research, the bigger the income gap in society, which is what we've got in the US and the UK and Portugal, the more people depend on buying to be recognised and gain status. Then it's almost sort of retail therapy. If I can choose where I buy, I've now got a wage coming in, I've got a councillor's wage coming in, and my husband's on a wage, and our kids to sort themselves out for a change, so that's good. So I can choose where I buy. I've managed not to go to Primark. However, my mates have to go to Primark because they haven't got any other place to go, or Asda or wherever. And Liverpool First, which is great for retail in Liverpool, because it's, in terms of having it as a retail centre, which is badly needed, is good. We've now got Debenhams and everything else. However, there's a whole section of people in Liverpool who feel very uncomfortable in Liverpool First because they feel it's not for them. They can't afford it. They won't go in there unless it's on the edges of it. And so there's an exclusion being built up within. So it's more about whether it's good to be able to buy what we need, but do we actually buy what we need, or do we just buy on top of that too much stuff that we actually don't need, which hits in with Alistair's agenda about green and waste and producing more, and then forcing the poorer countries to produce for us, so that it's this sort of, it worries me. I'd love to live much more simply, I mean, really, really simply. But if you buy a laptop, you know, can you easily get it mended? No, you can't. You know, years ago, I mean, I'm not that old, but I can remember when you went to the menders for things. Now you just throw everything away. So it's that sort of, it's consumerism or buying what we need and having the money to buy what we need.
Neil, you were talking, I wondered about, there's lots of work saying that inequality results in bigger mental health issues. And that's something you've thought about a bit, I think, is it?
A little bit, yeah. There's a very strong body of evidence now that says that, as Jane was kind of inferring, that the gap between those at the top and the bottom in a society, the wider it is, before it was just an issue for the poor, but the book that Jane's mentioned, the book by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett called The Spirit Level, has gone through in enormous detail, and buy that book, don't buy my book, because it's much, much better. It's gone through in enormous detail and looks at loads of data sets about people's lives, not just in Britain, but across the world, about how that gap between rich and poor affects not just those at the bottom in terms of the quality of their life, but those at the top as well, about the stresses and strains and insecurities of living in societies which have these huge gaps between the top and the bottom, and everyone suffers. And they measured it on kinds of, you know, rates of teenage pregnancies, obesity, a whole range of social indicators to say that the greater the gap between rich and poor, you know, the less happy, less secure, less fulfilled the whole of society is. So it's now kind of, if you add that to the happiness science, the Richard Layard stuff, which says, you know, we are now 3-4 times richer than we were, you know, 20-30 years ago, but we are no happier. For some strange reason, it's 1976. The cut-off point between the growth in income and the happiness level stopped going up together in 1976. It was the heatwave summer, I think. I don't know what it is about 76, but we are getting...
Something to do with punk, I think.
Punk rock. It was all to do with punk rock. So we are getting richer, but we are getting no happier, no more fulfilled. Because actually, all the science says that you need an income level of around about kind of £14,000-£15,000 a year to buy the stuff you need to keep you at a kind of safe, stable subsistence level. And then beyond that, it's actually pretty futile. But the point is, we keep doing it, and we all do it. We keep buying because we're all on this kind of competitive treadmill of buying status, buying recognition, competing with others, trying to dress individually and independently, and all the rest of it. Because we live in a society where we have this welter of information being presented to us all the time. They've calculated that we get 30,000 brand images a day that are, you know, that we see. I did the calculation in my book about how many that is, you know, an hour or whatever. It's a lot. So, you know, we are, you know, we catch consumerism. We're not taught it in schools. We learn it through our everyday life of shopping, streets, television, magazines, and we're fed this never-ending conveyor belt of wants that are turned into needs because there's a machine there that wants to profit from us, you know, buying more and more stuff. Despite the fact, and we're not stupid, we know it doesn't make us any happier, really. We know we get a kind of instant hit from the thrill of the till. But we know that we just go back again faster for more stuff because it isn't satisfying, because we know there's actually other things in life that we want. The problem is there isn't much else to do. There aren't enough festivals like this. So the vast majority of people in our country go shopping at the weekend as their leisure activity. They go with their family. They don't do it all the time, or we don't all shop all the time, and we're not obsessed by it. But increasingly, that's what we do to gain fulfilment, because that's all there is to do. And as Jane said, it is effectively retail therapy, and people know that. They know that they're just kind of buying an instant fix, but it won't solve the problems. It won't make them happier. It won't make them more secure. They know the environment's going to suffer as a consequence of it, and it's completely unsustainable. They know that we're closing down the space, the public spaces, the democratic spaces, to build alternatives. But there is nothing else. And while there's nothing else, and we don't create a better vision of the good society and the good life and give people the confidence that there is a way of making it happen, and if we work together, we can make it happen. And actually, a lot of people are feeling incredibly insecure. And enormous numbers of people are trying their best independently to break out of this and downsize and buy better and buy differently and do other things. But we need a kind of collective effort, all the way to the top, from our political masters through civil society to ourselves, to try and make a breakthrough. And I think, you know, as per the title of this conversation, I think the crash is a brilliant time to do it, despite the fact that, as again the title said, there are people who are losing their jobs and are suffering, and that's a bad thing. But it is a wake-up call for us. It is a moment when we can think about, let's not just go back to how things were before, because even when there was growth and even when there was money and people could buy things, there was and is a social recession, even in economic success, where the fabric of our society is being pulled apart because of the levels of inequality that Jane's mentioned and this other book has been talking about. So I see this as a huge opportunity for us to stop and think and reflect on the world that we live in and try and make sure that we start again in a different kind of way. And perhaps we could talk a bit more about, you know, what the prospects are for living and doing and being in a different kind of way.
Alistair. I wonder if you could talk a bit on the environment side of this. But as I was thinking about what to ask you, I thought, you know, we all perhaps can think what you might say next. So I wanted to spin it this way and say, what is going to happen in the next short period is the population of the world is going to rise in the poorer countries of the world. Those people don't have the access to consumerism that we've been talking about so far, and they want it, and you know, maybe that would be good for them to have that. So the population is going to go up, and much of the population of the world is going to want stuff. It doesn't have stuff like we have stuff. So isn't it actually the case that good science and good technology will enable us to continue exploiting our planet? That growth is good, and growth for people in poor countries is very important. And it's actually an intellectual happy talk for us to say we must stop consuming because it's hurting the planet, because a lot of people on the planet need to consume.
I think the issue here, as you're saying, is that population is rising. We're currently about 6.7, 6.8 billion people. In 1955, when I was born, it was 2.5 billion people. So you can see how quickly that's changed in 53 years. And the impact upon the environment is a product of population and consumption. Now, this is why it's not good enough for us to say the problem in the world is too many people breeding in Africa and India and what have you. Because actually, our rate of consumption in the West, our impact upon material resources and output of carbon dioxide, etc., is considerably in excess of population growth in many countries of the South. However, we've got to tackle both issues. You cannot just tackle one. In my view, we've got to tackle both consumerism, recognizing it as fundamentally a psychological and a spiritual problem that has been created very consciously during the 20th century by the tools of advertising, marketing, political and corporate policy. But we've also, I think, got to get population back onto the agenda. And I think the reason it went off the agenda in the 1970s is that following concern about population explosion, etc., in the 1960s, you had many authoritarian positions. Remember Sanjay Gandhi in India with his compulsory sterilization of villages, etc. You had a lot of authoritarian positions being taken in terms of basically trying to deal with the poor by population control. What we've actually seen happening since then is that populations naturally stabilize and start to come down when three primary conditions are in place. When women have got equality, so that women have a life outside of simply being child rearers and child carers. When women have something else to enjoy in life, apart from just the manner in which patriarchy, domination by men, has constructed it. Secondly, when you've got security in old age, so that people no longer have to have large numbers of children to do their work for them in old age, where we have a society where much of our effort is put over towards caring for people in their old age so they don't have to panic. And only thirdly, when you've got the medical or other forms of population, of birth control technology in place. And when you've got those three things in place, you start to get a very different paradigm. I think if you combine that with an ethos, a cultural ethos that actually values children and says, let's really look after the children we've got and not have children that we're not going to bother looking after, then you have the prospect of starting to align our level of consumption with our level of population and saying, what would be a sustainable population to have in this world so we can live with one planet living instead of living as if we've got three planets?
And I think you're going to tell us useful, practical things that we can do every day that make a difference. Is that right?
Well, certainly the idea which began, that we would engage people in big problems which we read about in the paper, which seem overwhelming. And we started this work 10 years ago when climate change was really not on the popular radar in the way that it is today. And while, you know, switching the light off and using less water and those sorts of things, which I think we all take as pretty much read these days, back then that was kind of quite a novel way to present these big, difficult to digest issues for people who are starting to get their heads around how they're connected with them on a daily basis. Activity, engaging people in issues through everyday behaviour. I don't for a second step away from that. But I do think now, 7 years on, in that work, I am looking to encourage people who have undertaken simple, basic, obvious steps to move to the next stage, which I would suggest is starting to make some significant and symbolic lifestyle changes, where we start to consider things like how much money we're earning, how much time we're working, how much time we're investing in our community, whether we do want to take as a given families where both parents work full time. Is that something which we think is acceptable? Things like what we do with money, if we have it, where we're putting it, how we're using it, those sorts of things. And I think for those of us who, you know, I certainly think everyone in this room has got their head round the value of simple everyday actions and not using plastic bags. For those of us who have got to that point, I think it is beholden upon us to now start to do the things which may be symbolic at first, but which are important in terms of leading the way. I think that we all can, it's a no-brainer. You know, we know that there's the science, there's the arguments, it's a complete no-brainer. What we need is some people to start living this life and being proud about it and telling people about it. I think you quoted, and I can't believe I've got this right, Neil, did you say 40% of people between the ages of 29 and...
25%.
25% of people between the ages of... 29 and 50 have made a significant... still pretty...
A 40% cut.
Have made a 40%... You should say it, hang on.
There's like some sort of ventriloquist dummy thing going on there. A gollar gear. There's an interesting fact. The survey has shown that 25%, a quarter of those aged between 29 and 59, have cut their income and therefore their expenditure by at least 40%. That's a massive... That's exactly the kind of change that Eugene is talking about. A different culture, a different lifestyle, making a decision. And so that's happening. And the issue is, how do you build a sum and parts thing out of those kinds of actions to create the kind of transformation that we want to see?
And I think I was so heartened when I heard that statistic from you today, because I think that's precisely the sort of change that's going to lead to a tipping point. So what I would encourage every person in this room to do is to think about, and quite likely many of you have already done so and made those changes, but I have myself made a significant change because I think not only is it important for me and our family, but I also think it's important to be a torchbearer for the sort of lifestyle. The person I have in mind that I want to change is Jamie Oliver. I, as I said, I like popular culture. I think these things have to, you know, seep into the pages of the weekend supplements and that kind of thing. And I, what I want is Jamie Oliver to disappear for a couple of years. Something really troubles me about him. He's prolific, he's brilliant, he's entrepreneurial. He represents so much of the period of the last 10 years, a young person with some talent, exploiting it, all that kind of stuff. And I don't deny him, you know, he's a product of all of this. But he's got three little girls. He's a chef, and I just wonder how much time he spends with them. And maybe he spends oodles, and maybe I've got it completely wrong. But I'd love him to disappear for a couple of years and then to hear from someone who knew him, who knew someone, who knew him, who knew someone, that actually he was a governor on his kid's school and he'd just taken it easy and he was, you know, I don't know what. But I want someone at that stature to make a change that I think will start to resonate with just everyday people.
Sounds pucker. So... How many people have been impacted by the work of We Are What We Do?
Wow. We've never had enough money to be able to track it. But, you know, 1 million people have bought that first little book. And as I've said a couple of times at the festival, it's the first book in the history of the world, I think, that's every time it sells a copy, it loses us some money, which isn't to say don't go and buy it, but it's not a great business model. we've got a couple of million actions registered on our website. We did a project which put, you know, the plastic bag issue on the front page of newspapers and had women in Taiwan hitting each other over the heads at the launch to get their hands on it. You know, I think any number of people...
Can you just tell us a bit more about that?
I'm not a plastic
too
bag.
Too interesting for me.
I'm not a plastic bag, you know, of course. So I think lots of people in different ways have been touched by the work. We're a minnow. What I'm interested in doing... Neil, in your book you talk about harnessing the power of creativity in advertising, and in Change the World for Fiverr, I think what's so exciting about that book, 200 advertising creative people donated time and energy. It's not that people who are brilliant and creative and talented don't want to, you know, give their time and energy to creating compelling ways of presenting this world that we're talking about. They're there and they want to do it. And I'm interested in thinking about how we do that with a television format or how we do that, you know, in other ways. So, you know, we do is a minnow. We've got a long way to go. But very thanks.
What we're going to do next is open up to some questions. So I think you've got a feeling for the different people on our panel. I'm going to use the old-fashioned low technology of the whiteboard. And let's take five questions... I don't see five hands yet, but let's get five questions and let's get them on the board and we'll see what happens next.
Lies, damn lies and statistics. The 25% quote you just came up with, how many of those people were forced to actually cut their expenditure because they were made redundant, for example?
Right.
And how many was there an actual lifestyle choice, if you like?
I'm going to paraphrase that into something else. Along the lines of, are all these downsizers choosing or forced? Question number two. Dave, you're the man in the blue. Off you go.
Hello. I've got a question about the whole credit crunch. We were told by the government to basically spend more to get out of the credit crunch, which was a bit confusing. But also in terms of cities that you see regenerating themselves, they tend to do it from using, you know, building more shopping centres, which produces more jobs for people in retail. So if you're telling us not to spend... I always have that guilt of if I don't spend in that shop, then that shop will close and then people will be out of business. So I just feel...
There's a bloke called Keynes, he'd have liked you.
So I don't really... Yeah, I feel a bit stuck, a bit catch-22. I don't want to spend stuff, but I feel guilty spending,
right.
Not spending. And then also on that, a lot of charities are saying, buy this necklace from India made by a women's cooperative. So you feel like to help people in developing world, you should buy a necklace that you don't need and all that stuff.
Demand generation, let's call it that. Demand generation is good. Or is it?
Right. You said the average wage is for 15,000. Well, I was 5 on a year, about 7,000 for the last 3 years. And if we all buy the books that you say we should all around Greenbelt and other places, and we'd be even poorer. And another thing, why are books not on CDs for people who all can't read very easily?
Who are you?
How much money do you make, guys, make?
Oh, sorry.
Does that make any sense?
I was so baffled by trying to find out where you were.
Right. Timmy said the average wage is about 15,000. Well, the last 3 years, my wage is about 8,000 a year. And I still pay a mortgage. But if we buy every book that you say we should buy and other bits and pieces, we'd be all being poorer and listen to come to people on the stage making a living for doing things like this. Perhaps we should change coming to places where spend that much money. You with me? Oh, I lost you.
Sounds a bit similar to the previous question, along the lines of, is actually spending useful to each other? Is it a community activity to be consuming? because it gives other people jobs.
You're telling us to buy the books consumerism, which makes it even poorer, which makes you in a job.
Yeah, are we that's a great question. Are you panellists professional worriers? Let's have that. Question number four. Can you wave your hand? Thank you.
Has the credit crunch actually changed anything in that already some papers are saying, oh, we're on our way back, we're starting to... mortgage applications are increasing, we're getting better, and it looks as though we're heading back to be exactly where we were before. Whether or not we are recovering yet, has it actually changed anything? Will it be different when we do recover?
So is this as big a seismic shift as it might be or not? Yeah, all right. And let's have the fifth question.
Okay, you can hear me? My name's Andy. I've been reading a book called Enough is Enough, and there's an interesting bit. It was written in the 1970s by a John V. Taylor, and it says that we're to be fools for Christ's sake. The word silly originally meant to be blessed, merry, innocent, guileless, holy, but that combination of qualities appears ordinary in the eyes of the general world. And it says that simple is the same thing. It's been corrupted, and it's not seen as a valued commodity. What I want to ask the panellists is, it seems that for us to truly live within our means and to live as Christians, we need to be silly. We need to be fools for Christ's sake. And how do we form communities of cheerful rebels who can act counter to the common culture around us? How can we do that? Because it seems it can't be done alone. It seems it needs to be done in community. So how can we do it in a cheerful way?
That's a great question. Can I spin that a little bit? Tell me if I'm cheating here. I think I'd like to ask the panel, do Christians have to be poor? And can we be happy communities as poor? Is that, am I just corrupting your question too far then? That's the question I thought. How can we live simply, cheerfully? Is that better? How can we live simply, cheerfully? Don't know if anyone can read my writing anymore. Happily. Oh, that's the same thing. Community. Thank you very much. Sorry. Right. I don't know if you guys can read this, but you've got five meaty topics. And why don't we start with Alistair?
Is it a big seismic shift or not? I mean, you don't want us to work through each one.
Not really.
Presumably, or we'll be here all night.
Take your pick.
Is it a big seismic shift or not? And demand generation, is it good or not? I don't think it is a big seismic shift. I think it's part of the way that capitalism works. There's that famous calculation that I verified for myself recently, and I figured out the basis you need to do it on to verify it, which is that if the 30 pieces of silver that Judas was paid had been invested at 5% compound interest to be repaid today in silver, how much silver would be required to do it? And the answer is the weight of the earth. The weight of the earth at 5%. If you increase the percentage, it goes up and so on. And the reason for that is that compound interest, exponential interest, works on a basis that nature does not work. Nature works on simple interest. With nature, if you don't pick this year's crop of apples, they rot. and you don't get the same plus 5 or 10% next year. Whereas the sin of usury, as it was traditionally seen in all of the three principal Abrahamic religions, today it's only really the Muslims that take it seriously, the sin of usury, the sin of lending money at the expectation of a compound interest rate of return, or else you will dispossess the lender. That sin puts us into a situation where we force other human beings and we force the earth to produce beyond sustainability. And that is why I think one of the steps which we need to take is to stop looking for the highest rate of return when we invest money. Preferably do what Jesus says, lend it without expectation of a rate of return. But it also shows us that boom and bust is intrinsic to that kind of system. That kind of system, the advanced capitalist system, is sinful because it is going to hurt people. And it's not the rich that gets hurt. The people who get hurt are the people having their houses taken off them just now, which will be bought up by speculators who will be the rich of the future. And therefore, I don't think that we can say that the kind of economic crash we have just seen is necessarily a good thing because it hits the wrong people.
Demand generation or not, I think there's a line in there somewhere about working out what we need and then making a real choice that if we can get it fairly traded, ethically produced, we go for that. If we can't because it's more expensive and actually our income is very low, that's a choice we have to make. And sometimes, you know, we have to, for people in Everton, quite often they have to wait until they're allowed to have that choice. If then there's a choice later on to say, okay, if I'm going down the route of having a bit of a luxury, could I actually do it to benefit somebody else as well? So it's just, I think it's a checklist in your head. But I think sometimes we can get too wound up about it because there's so much, your point about there's so much coming in at us all the time. It's actually quite hard to be able to just chill out. Every so often I go to Iona, the little community in the little island in Scotland, and it takes me about half a day probably to get back into the mode of having all this stuff coming at me. And it's just lovely to be there with nothing coming at me in terms of, you know, all the adverts and the billboards and everything else. Is it a big seismic shift or not? Oh, are you panellists professional workers? No, I got asked to, not really. Is it a big seismic shift or not? I think it could be, and I think we've got to keep the door open and our foot into the door to say, let's not go back to how we were before. Let's really try and make this different. And I think there's enough people around, if we all keep our foot in the door, to keep saying, whoa, hang on a minute, let's check this out. Let's not go back to the default position of just going down the road that we were before. And that, I think, links up with something in our community which is looked down on, which picks up your point from John V. Taylor's quote about the people in Everton who have no money, very little money, are some of the hardest workers I know. I can see one of them standing at the back, who will work their guts out for stuff free in the community, but that isn't necessarily recognised by society, and are some of the most generous people I know. And if you look at, say, if a funeral happens in Everton, everybody piles in and looks out for each other and looks after each other, and the food is put on. And there's another thing I thought of. A mate of mine, Wendy, died, and she'd worked flat out in the community for free for years. She didn't have a paid job. When people went to her funeral, did anybody stand up and say, well, Wendy, of course, she had this, this and this materially? No, of course they didn't. What they said was, Wendy was incredibly generous. She made... had lovely friends, look at what she managed to do helping us out in the community. It was all about character, it was all about what people were putting in. And the other thing about Everton is people celebrate all the time. Can't we have another cake? We've got a celebration. We've just won a project. Come on, let's go for it. And you get that lovely sort of what society should be like in a community that is labelled. And the last thing to say is, I think we should ban the word, the phrase, the poor. People are people. Everybody is equal in God's eyes. Everybody's made in the image of God. So let's not class them into the rich and the poor. People living in poverty, people living with riches, people living with excessive riches, But yes, there could be celebration and the communities. And funnily enough, the poorest communities often are the ones who celebrate the best because they just get on with life together. It's great. So I love Everton.
The point about the downsizers, well, these were voluntary decisions. And what's interesting about the evidence on downsizers is there's a kind of myth that it's all kind of Tom and Barbara's from The Good Life, the people, you know, the middle classes who can afford to do it. Actually, the evidence seems to suggest that it's pretty much across every socioeconomic group. People are making decisions to have less income and more time. So I think that's an interesting fact. I just want to join together the demand generation one and the living simply one. I think it's impossible to make your, you know, you make your judgment about buying stuff and putting people out of work within the system as it is. When we're all on the conveyor belt, when buying things are all there is and having more money to buy things. So we have to work out a way of making our own individual decisions about what we buy and what actions that we take. But we also need to make a collective, social, national decision about what kind of world we want. Because actually, the people whose jobs you're trying to protect quite rightly would be better probably if they worked less and had more time and bought less stuff and spent more time with their friends and their family and investing in their community and reading and doing a whole load of things other than having that job to buy that stuff that doesn't really make them happen, to make them happy. So you've got to find a way of doing things individually, but within a kind of collective top-down and bottom-up way. And that's the same thing about the kind of simple living stuff as well. The problem is that when the definition of success and happiness is buying more stuff as opposed to sharing time, doing things that people used to do, there's a great book by a guy called Tom Hodgkinson called The Idler, which, you know, talks about the way in which people used to celebrate and have festivals and days off and the way in which all of that was changed and we were forced from the land into the factories and the factories produced stuff so we had to buy the stuff and we all became consumers. You know, I'm not saying that we should jump in a time machine and go back to some rural idyll. That isn't possible and isn't likely and may not even be welcome. But we need to get to this tipping point where society and people judge themselves by what they give, how much they care, how much they cooperate, how much compassion they have, other judgments and other values, and we need to create that critical mass through the kind of individual actions we're talking about, but also through collective effort as well. And to answer the last bit about is this a seismic shift or not, who knows? When Chairman Mao was asked about the French Revolution, he said it's too early to tell. Now, how do we know about this one? We don't know yet what the implications of this crash are going to be. But what I do know is that Karl Marx said we make history but not in conditions of our own choosing. We have to do whatever we can to change things. And if you look back at politicians who seized the moment, Mrs. Thatcher in 79, she comes in and she sells people council houses. She privatises the nationalised industries. She gets the big bang and so therefore we get all of the credit and all of the ability to buy. She scraps the Sunday trading law. She does everything she can to change the conditions in which we're not just consumers, we're turbo consumers. Now, we need to do the things that we think need to happen to create the conditions in which more can happen. And that's why I'm interested in a politics which begins to unite people who want a more equal world, a sustainable, a democratic world. And I think people at this festival, which I'd never heard of this festival before. I didn't know there was this oasis in Cheltenham once a year where 20,000 people, you know, which I can see, you know, decent people with progressive values come together. And I think you do good things in your community and through your faith organisations. But that isn't enough. It's not enough to get the world that we want. You have to work with other people in other places, and there has to be not just individual and civil society actions, there has to be a political catalyst to make this happen if we don't want to go back, if we don't want to turn back to how things are, and if we want to make this into a seismic shift. You have to struggle for things, and you have to fight for things, and you have to organise for things if you want them to happen. And if you don't, they won't.
I don't think there's anything to add after that, and I think those five questions have been well covered. The only thing I would add is to the fifth question, how do we live simply, cheerfully, and happily and communally? I would propose the Gandhi quote, be the change you want to see in the world. Go do those things. Be that happy, cheerful person. You will attract those people to you, and before you know it, you'll have a community around you. And I completely agree, Neil, with what you're saying. We have to reach out. We have to act with others. We have to connect. We can't just, think it's enough to do these things ourselves. But having said that, that is where you should start. And once you've done that, then reach out. But I think there's a danger of going, do I reach out? Do I do myself? Do I shop? Don't I shop? Listen to your own conscience. Find your own heart and your soul and your own values. Tap into that. Live the life that that tells you. Make the decisions that that will guide you. I promise you it will. And then you will be on your own path. You will attract others to you, and you will find your way to connect and reach out to others.
I have a simple question for the group. Would we be happier to call it a day there, or would we be happier if we had two or three more questions? So, hands up for call it a day.
You guys.
Hands up for a few more questions. Well, I'm pretty lukewarm.
There's a little kid here,
and
he's gone now. We've got a question.
I think he's gone.
Oh, is he gone?
That's my son.
Is it?
How about this? Let's do two more questions, and then then we'll call it a day, because we didn't get overwhelming more questions. So we'll do a couple more, and then we will call it a day.
And the parable of the steward. Jesus talked about using your gifts and talents and multiplying them to further his kingdom. And the parable of the talents, the faithful servants multiplied their talents greatly. My interpretation of the position that we have in this country as citizens of the world in comparison to those in other countries that have much less is we have a great responsibility to use the resources available to us. So I believe that we should use our material resources and work hard to maximise the absolute, produce as much as we possibly can so that we can help out people in other countries that simply don't have those opportunities. So my interpretation of the capitalist society that we live in as a Christian, born-again Christian, is I see my responsibility as using those opportunities to help people that don't have opportunities. So therefore I say, work hard, use the skills you have, and use them to further God's kingdom.
Can I ask you a qualifying question? Because I'm not entirely clear of your question, really. Are you talking about our resources in terms of our mineral wealth, in terms of our intellectual wealth, in terms of what are those resources that you're thinking of?
Well, in terms of material wealth, everybody in this country is fabulously wealthy in comparison to those in other countries like Mali in Africa. So we have a great responsibility in using that vast material wealth in comparison to those in other countries. It takes 40p a day to educate a child in North India, a Dalit child that is regarded in their society as untouchable. So 40p a day is nothing to absolutely everybody in this room. We have a responsibility to use that.
Right.
How does that fit in with your analysis of consumerism?
It seems to suggest you're talking about giving more.
Absolutely. Okay. But also in terms of not just saying that, oh, we shouldn't work. I think that work is a great value, and we have an opportunity.
I'll just do a bit of work on that. Okay.
We have an opportunity in this country to use our talents, not just sit about and do nothing. We use our resources to help other people.
Get busy for others.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's have another question.
My question is a bit big picture. The trend towards consumption, so the advertising, the public relations selling you everything, has created a lot of choices and made us all individuals in our choices. Does this stop us acting communally?
I think that's a great question. Is choice, consumer choice, dividing us into non-action? Okay, let's do one more question and then we'll stop at that.
Hi. Basically, if everyone in the country reduces their income, everyone in the country reduces the amount of tax they're paying. Bearing in mind that the NHS only just survives on the amount of tax income it's currently getting, with 40% less income, how is that going to work?
Should the health service be stripped back to something basic?
Basically, yeah. I mean, I work in an intensive care unit with 30 beds. With 40% less funding, that would be 12 people we'd have to pull the plug on.
If we get poorer, we get poorer. Okay, less income equals less social benefits. So, get more income. Jeannie.
Just on that last point, I think the point is the evidence would suggest that earning less and working less will lead to health. I mean, there will be a correlation between that and people living healthier lives, and that a lot of the money that's spent on public health through the NHS would be avoided. I think that's the logic that one, you know, would follow there.
On the health side, that's where the Wilkinson Pickett stuff comes in as well, in terms of health inequalities, if you look at their stuff coming through, because actually the amount of money spent on looking after people who are under chronic stress and anxiety, and chronic stress and anxiety breaks down, as you know, your ability to be able to fight against diseases, and Everton has one of the highest levels of poor health in England. Actually, if the income gap between rich and poor was made smaller, as it is in Sweden, Japan and other countries, then actually our health service wouldn't be under so much pressure. And I can see faces, literally, of people in Everton who have died far, far too young. And it's just not on. And in terms of a God agenda, God is saying, this is not on, this must stop. So I like your correlation between income, health, but I think there's a sort of, that there's a bit in the middle that we're saying, this is the missing link in our thinking and understanding, that whole income gap stuff, which then goes back a bit to the consumerism, because the bigger the gap, the more people consume. Yeah, the other one about get busy for others, yeah, quite agree. We have got a massive responsibility to look out for our brothers and sisters across the world, as well as in our own country as well, and make sure that we're looking out for people. I didn't understand the middle one. I'm really sorry, but I'm sure someone else does.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a myth. This is a myth that we're all individuals. This is what they try and sell us, that we go and pick out our outfits and we're all, look at me, I'm independent, I make my own choices. And we kind of all think we do, and we're kind of all kidding ourselves, really, because we all, but look at us in this room. And if you go to any room, it's a kind of set of clothing and a set of records and a set of books and a set of furniture, which is all broadly pretty much the same, really, because that's all there is. And we make tiny little individual decisions about, you know, shades and colours and patterns or whatever, But it's all mass churned out stuff that we all buy, and we all console ourselves that, oh, look at me, I'm an individual because I've got, you know, a slightly different shade of pink or some pattern that's slightly different. And it's used to, you know, it's used to get us to buy more because, you know, next week it's a different shade of pink, and you, this week you chuck out your chintz, and next week it's something, you know, supposedly completely different, but it isn't really any different. It's just there to keep you on the treadmill. It's there to get you to compete with others, to judge your status against others, and have you got the latest car or the latest this or the latest that, and if you haven't, then you're a failure and you're not keeping up and you're not doing well. So it, you know, it is there to divide us, and it is there to keep, you know, to keep us on the treadmill. Galbraith said there are many visions of the good society. The treadmill is not one of them, and he was absolutely right. And it, you know, so it does divide us. It stops us seeing the big things in the world that unite us, the big things that ought to keep us together, the big things that we have in common. It makes us think we can buy our way out of big issues and big problems individually rather than collectively. And we've got to become bigger and better than that and see more to it. In terms of the other one, I mean, this is difficult stuff. You know, there may be less income for other things, but we have a whole range of choices about, you know, do we want Trident? Do we want ID cards? Apart from, you know, kidney machines and rockets and guns or whatever Paul Weller, you know, spoke about or wrote about or sung about. There are a whole number of choices. And as Jane was saying, it is a disgrace that in a rich society, poor people die younger than poor people in poorer societies. It's the stress and strain of living in a rich society that kills people sooner because of all of the anxiety and all of the insecurity and, frankly, all of the shame of being poor in a richer society. There's a whole load of stuff in that. We need to make collective decisions about what kind of society we want, and that notion of the gap between the rich and the poor and what we want to spend our money on. And we don't have those decisions really about kind of where we want to spend our money because we're all too busy off down the shops buying things, pretending to be individuals when we're not really. And in terms of the first question, look, I don't honestly think that putting people in the developing world on the consumer treadmill is the answer for us or them. I honestly don't. And that's where this stuff gets difficult about, you know, moral judgments, elitism, you've got this stuff, they haven't, you know, they should have it. Well, if they're just, you know, putting them on the first stages of the treadmill, that they're going to end up on this conveyor belt, buying more stuff, wanting more stuff, people in India, people in China, people in developing countries behind them, that's all their life is about, consuming more and more stuff. I don't think that's the good society or the good life. I do think there is something about work and the dignity of work. The greatest thing that we give after our love is our labour, and we should give it properly. But that shouldn't be about producing rubbish stuff for us to pretend we're individuals and we're not. It should be about labour, about caring, about compassion, about community, about working with others, about a whole range of things. And yes, there has to be a transfer of resources in rich countries like ours from the rich to the poor. And the people who are cash rich but time poor, we should work out a way of transferring that to people who don't have much money but have an awful lot of time. And clearly we have to work out a way of transferring resources from rich countries to developing countries. But that shouldn't just be about making them like us and putting them on the consumer treadmill. We should be doing something with them to work out a different way of being free, a different way of being human, a different way of fulfilling our lives, rather than just giving them consumer rubbish and making them like us.
Do you have a pulpit that you speak in on a regular basis? No, no, maybe not.
I'd like to just focus on that second question, which I'll sum up as, does consumerism violate community? What is consumerism? I would define consumerism as consumption in excess of sufficiency. So up to a level of what we need for dignified living, that's legitimate, justified consumption. The earth and our fellow humankind cannot grudge us that. But when we move to a point where we move beyond what we need for sufficient living, then we start being the exploiter. Then we get into a situation where we are the rich and the earth can no longer afford the rich. And as was noted, when Jesus spoke to the rich young man, he went away sadly because he was very rich. It is difficult to face that. And what is a community that consumerism violates? I would say that that community has got three pillars. There is community with one another in society. There is community with the earth, community of soil. And there is community deep within ourselves. Within a Christian framework, I live, yet not I, but Christ lives within me. And you find similar expressions in other great mystical religions. Hinduism, Atman, the individual soul, ultimately is Brahman, the universal soul. And what that teaches us is that true community is about our interrelationship with all that is both manifest in the expression of God immanent in the incarnation, and that which is transcendent, that which is hidden from us. And the problem with consumerism is that it sells us what Richard Rohr, who has previously spoken here, calls the false liminal. The liminal is a threshold. The threshold of consciousness that you cross over to see deep into the meaning of life. The liminal is what spirituality, what true religion is about. It is a search to find God. And consumerism, as excess beyond sufficiency, simply tries to sell us a stairway to heaven. And that's why, although we try and we try and we try, we can't get no satisfaction when we appeal to that kind of idolatry.
Then I was trying to let a pause elapse before I come in after that, but I just wanted to, I brought this with me because the Sustainable Development Commission has produced some fantastic materials in the last 6-12 months, and this one I think is terrific, which is called Sustainable Lives, and it's 10 Principles of Sustainable Lifestyle. And if anyone was looking for a document which had 10 pointers of the sorts of questions or statements one might want to make about oneself. Healthy life for all. I accept that I'm responsible for nurturing my own physical, mental and emotional health. I'm able to cope with related problems or if or when they happen. I'm conscious about what it takes to be content and satisfied with my life, and I'm comfortable that these ambitions are achievable. And there's 10 points like that about a various range of topics, which I think is really a helpful guide. And another one which is called Prosperity Without Growth? A terrific report, which I would commend to everybody here. So I don't think the Sustainable Development Commission's materials get a wide enough audience beyond the kind of, those sort of circles, and I'm really keen to try and push them out and get more people to read them. They're brilliant, they're accessible, and they're really useful.
So thank you very much to our panellists for coming. It was really very, very informative and lively. Thank you. Thank you very much to you for coming and listening. And go and have a wonderful evening and enjoy the rest of the festival. Thanks very much.